The Heaven Field, a novel by I.G. Hume, read by the author. Episode 11, An Old Ghost. Thomas stood nervously at the glass door of the library. It was still only 10 to 5. He had been wandering around the same corridors for the past 20 minutes, wasting time, trying not to arrive early. He peered through the glass and saw Susan walk around to the reception desk. He stepped back in embarrassment, not wishing to be caught watching her, but she had already looked up and spotted him. A smile spread across her face and she waved a greeting to him. Thomas nervously waved back. Susan glanced at her watch for a moment, then beckoned him in. He fumbled with the door, catching his foot on it and stumbling. He noticed Miss Moran let out a carefree giggle. "Careful, that door bites," she smiled as Thomas reached her. "I'll just sort the lights out, then we can get going. Are you sure you don't mind me tagging along?" she asked as she shut down her computer. "No, please, not at all," stammered Thomas. "Oh, great. I'm dying to see what she says," whispered Susan excitedly. "I've heard so much gossip about it all. You know, where did she come from? Is she real in the same sense that we are? It's like it makes you reevaluate our whole perspective on life and everything, really." She trailed off with a giggle. "Oh, sorry, I'm rambling again. I'll just roll a ciggy then, we can get off. Sorry, oh, I've forgotten your name again. I'm terrible with names. Not the best way for a librarian to be." "Thomas," he said quietly. "What have you heard about the lady in the video?" he asked while she took out an old tobacco tin and rolled a cigarette on the reception desk. "Oh, not much really. I just heard that she kept appearing, like some sort of ambassador or something. And then she was gone. They never saw her again after they first entered the Heaven Field." "The Heaven Field?" echoed Thomas. Is that what they call it?" "Only some of them, Grace and a few of the others, but I like it," she smiled, delicately licking the gum on her cigarette paper. "So the woman didn't die in the accident?" asked Thomas, confused by it all. "You don't know?" asked Susan, with a perplexed look on her face. Thomas shook his head. "Oh, it's amazing. But come on, you can see for yourself." She grabbed her jacket and headed for the door, Thomas following behind. They walked up through the levels in silence, Susan occasionally humming snatches of a tune to herself. They reached the main lifts and squeezed in amongst the crowd of people. By the time they reached the surface level, Thomas and Susan were alone.
"Are you sure you don't mind taking me?"
hissed Susan a little nervously, as they walked along amongst the bustle of military personnel.
"No, not at all," stuttered Thomas, himself anxious amongst so many uniforms.
Someone let out a low wolf whistle as they left the main building. Susan blushed and giggled to herself.
"The information centre's that one over there," she said, pointing at a squat, nondescript grey building.
Between them and the centre, a cavalcade of vehicles was drawn up, many of them police cars. Thomas looked worriedly at the throng of people around him. He caught sight of Grace Palmer coming towards him, led by a stern-looking man in a long overcoat, and followed by two uniformed officers. Grace looked terrible. She was haggard and had a glazed look of submission on her face.
"Dr. Palmer, are you all right?"
asked Susan as Grace walked past. Grace glanced up in alarm, looked blankly at Susan, and then spotted Thomas.
"Oh, Thomas," she said, pausing by him.
The stern man looked testily at his watch.
"I'm sorry I got you involved in all this," she said, with an expression of sorrow.
What's happening?" asked Thomas in concern.
"There was an EM spike from the array. I don't know how we ever missed it. It was foolish. It caused a plane crash, Thomas. There were so many killed. So many."
She looked up at the overcast skies with tears in her eyes.
"But that can't be," stuttered Thomas to himself. "Surely the very nature's standing point. Would negate any field. Keeler wrote of the Hotchkiss effect when..."
"Dr. Palmer," interrupted the detective. Grace looked at Thomas curiously for a moment, then was swept away by the detective and into the leading car.
"Why is Grace in trouble?" asked Susan from behind Thomas.
He jumped, broken from his train of thought. He couldn't shake the feeling that there was something out of place.
"We don't have to go now, if it's a bad time," said Susan with a look of concern on her face.
"No, it's fine," said Thomas in a distracted tone.
"Let's go."
Alex jumped, opening his eyes in panic. The compartment was in chaos, filled with debris and smoke. Slowly, he realized that the vehicle had turned completely over, and everything was upside down. He felt around in the darkness until he found Yuri's body, but he couldn't get any response from him. The sounds of the creatures outside seemed further off now, though he couldn't see anything except dust through the broken windows. Suddenly, there was a crash, as something struck the inner door of the airlock. Another crash, and he saw the door buckle inwards. Frantically, Alex fumbled around in the gloom for anything he might use as a weapon, but there was nothing. A third blow, and the door burst inwards. Alex scrambled backwards in terror, as he saw a dark silhouette loom through the opening. "Hello? Is there anybody alive in there?" Alex almost cried out in relief as he recognized the familiar shape of an environment suit in the doorway. "Are you okay? Can you walk?" the figure asked urgently. Alex let himself be led away in a half-dream. He was bundled into the back of another transport vehicle, and sat shivering in his suit as Yuri was carried in and propped up beside him. After a few moments, Peter and Ekusteyna were helped limping into the compartment. Three more figures crowded in beside them, and the vehicle set off with a lurch. Sounds of explosions echoed some way off, and then Alex dimly saw concrete walls through the dusty windows. The vehicle slowed to a halt, the whine of the engines fading into an eerie stillness. One of the figures turned to him. "Don't worry, Alexei. You're safe now."
"Hello, Miss Moran. Are you working late again?" asked the security guard at the reception desk.
Hi, Joe. Something like. I was just going to show Mr. Sullivan here how to use the database down in the information centre.
She fidgeted nervously as Thomas stood beside her, holding out his clearance card. The security guard looked at him with a bemused expression, then a half-smile. Susan followed his gaze.
Oh no, Thomas, that's the computer login key card. He needs to see that one.
She unclipped Thomas's lapel badge and gave it to the guard with an apologetic smile.
Sorry, I'm not much good at, mumbled Thomas.
"There you are, sir," cut in the guard, running a hand scanner over the badge and handing it back to Thomas. "You have access through to sub-level 3. If you require further access, an escort is required to be present. You can contact me and I will organise that for you. Have a good day, sir. Susan."
Sub-level 3 will be more than enough," said Susan with a nervous smile. "Thanks, Joe." "God, Thomas, you really have got access to the whole lot," whistled Susan in awe, as they walked down a bright corridor to one of the lifts. "I didn't even know it went beyond sub-level 3.
Really, I don't know why," said Thomas.
They descended to sub-level 1, and the lift doors opened onto a small, bare foyer. Susan led Thomas through this and out into a huge hall filled with rows and rows of shelves, stretching off into the distance, all of them overflowing with files, folders, and boxes of documents. Thomas gasped at the scale of it.
"Fab, isn't it?" whispered Susan. "I wouldn't want to dust it, though. Come on."
She led him to the far side of the hall, where many alcoves were set into the wall, a computer terminal in each. They passed several uniformed staff as they went, some pushing trolleys stacked precariously with piles of papers. Thomas smiled nervously at each one. Most ignored him. Susan sat down at one of the terminals, and Thomas drew up a chair next to her. He caught the scent of her perfume and let his eyes linger on the back of her neck, her short hair gleaming in the soft light from the desk lamp.
"Have you got that card?" she said, looking around.
Thomas's eyes darted guiltily away, and he felt his cheeks go red. He fumbled in his jacket pocket and pulled out the key card. Susan grinned at Thomas as she inserted the card into a slot on the terminal, and saw a long directory list of available information appear.
"Right, where should we start?" she whispered with an excited smile.
I don't know. What is there?"
he asked, leaning forward, intrigued by the list.
"Oh, here's the audio transcription that goes with the Haydn experiment. It should have the woman in the chamber on it."
"They know what she said?"
asked Thomas quietly, his curiosity aroused.
"Apparently Maunsworth picked up her voice with the transmission signal," she said, scanning through the lists. "Ah, here we are."
She found the relevant entry and clicked on it. Up sprang a page of text, transcribed from the audio signal which Maunsworth received. Thomas felt a strange chill as he read the words. Transcript of audio recording. Standing Point Maunsworth. 16:42 p.m. Let me help you. I can help you. Come with me. I am yours. Let me help you. Have me. Have me. I am yours. Let me help. Weird, breathed Susan from next to Thomas. Well, I wasn't expecting that, she giggled. Who do you think she was? Asked Thomas. I don't know, but look, here's a load of other entries for her. Shall we take a look? She clicked on another of the links before Thomas had time to answer. A familiar piece of video footage appeared, the inside view of the array chamber, this time bereft of all equipment. They could hear audio from control playing in the background. Thomas heard a woman's voice, instantly recognisable as Grace's, counting down towards standing point. The picture flickered for an instant, and both Thomas and Susan gasped. There was the girl, standing unashamedly naked in the centre of the chamber. Thomas could hear the excited exclamations of the control room crew. Let me help you, began the girl, her voice faint and distorted on the tape. There was something in her tone that gave Thomas a shiver down his spine. He felt as though he shouldn't be listening, as if that voice wasn't meant for human ears. Can you hear us? Cut in Grace's voice, unsteady with excitement. The girl continued her monologue, staring unsettlingly into the camera. Who are you? Asked Grace again. In the background, Thomas made out a faint voice talking to her. There was a sigh, then they heard her say, Okay, prepare to shut it down on my mark. 3, 2, 1. The picture flickered for a moment, then once again the chamber was empty. Phew, that gave me the creeps, grinned Susan, as if she had just come off a scary fairground ride. Shall we do some more? Thomas didn't hear her. He was consumed with curiosity. Just who was the girl? And more importantly, where did she come from? Was the standing point field transporting her from another place? This world or another? His mind raced. Susan was scanning through more video clips. All were similar to the first. Standing point would be achieved, and the camera would flicker. Then the girl would appear, repeating the same stream of words in that unearthly voice. Oh, that's a little disappointing, sighed Susan, upon seeing the hopeless repetition of the scene. Still, it's crazy to think that. Oh my. Susan stopped mid-sentence as she came across another video clip. Thomas looked up from his thoughts. There was the familiar scene, the empty chamber suddenly inhabited by the naked girl. But this time something was different. Instead of instantly commencing her speech, the girl just stood, looking around the interior of the chamber, as if viewing it for the first time. It's not the same girl, whispered Susan excitedly. She looks the same to me, breathed Thomas, engrossed by the film. The girl walked slowly around the chamber, a calm smile on her face. She did look the same, thought Thomas, but Susan was correct. The woman's body language was entirely different, now confident and aware. She turned self-assuredly towards the camera. We have waited, came a low voice from her mouth. Again, it was different to the previous tapes, though her face was identical. Can you hear me? Cut in Grace excitedly. I can hear you, replied the girl. Thomas felt gripped by a curious fear at the inflection in her voice. He found it difficult to look at her. It is safe for you to follow me, said the woman, with a wry smile on her lips. And with that, she was gone. Susan sat back in her chair and looked at Thomas. Spooky, she said, and then laughed out loud. Thomas found her voice refreshing and musical after the sheer alien tone of the girl in the chamber. Well, now I know how it all started, though I don't think I'd be brave enough to follow her into the field after that. God, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, do you think... But anyway, thank you, Thomas. You're really kind. Let me buy you a drink, she said with a smile. Thomas looked at his watch in surprise. It was nearly 8:30. Are you sure you don't mind? He stuttered. I'd love to. It's my treat. Thomas stood up and fumbled to put his jacket on. He turned and walked back towards the lift, his mind full of all the possibilities he had witnessed. You better put this on a chain or something, laughed Susan, As she caught up with him, she handed Thomas his keycard. You really wouldn't want to have to explain losing that. Alex stumbled down the ramp of the tracked vehicle, helped by one of the suited figures. He looked on as Chris and Peter followed him, helping to carry Yuri's limp body. They were in a huge, bare concrete hangar with a towering steel-shuttered gate at one end. Deafening booms and crashes resounded upon it as the terrifying creatures outside attempted to beat it down. The motley party stumbled into a large airlock, and gases swirled around them as the atmosphere was restored. Alex looked at his comrades. They were covered with dust and corrosion from the harsh environment of the field, and Chris bore a large dent on one side of her helmet. After a brief pause, the inner door slid open, revealing an enormous, brightly lit hall. Medical orderlies ran forward to help the wounded, and Yuri was placed upon a stretcher and carried off. People bustled all around, helping Alex off with his suit and dressing his minor injuries. But Alex's attention was taken up by the sheer scale of the room he was in. A huge, high hangar with row upon row of lockers, each with an environment suit in an alcove next to it, enough to equip a small army. He was amazed how much they had achieved since he had last been here, when the outpost was merely a collection of small concrete bunkers.
"Alex, it's so good to see you safe," came a familiar voice.
Alex looked up from his thoughts.
"Ed? So you really did make it?" "I never did find out if you got out in time," croaked Alex.
"You didn't think you'd get rid of me that easily, did you?" laughed the man. It was Edmund Keeler, once head of research at Hyden Hill.
"I just heard you had a few surprises ahead of schedule," said Alex.
"You could say that.
But anyway, they'll fill you in on it later, I'm sure. But it sounds as if you didn't have everything your own way at Maundsworth," sighed Keeler.
He was a small, bony man with a scruffy, greying beard and a large nose. He looked tired, yet his eyes sparkled with life. Alex sighed to himself. He sat on a low bench and allowed an orderly to help him remove the rest of his suit.
"We were set up," he whispered. "The whole team gone. Even Drago."
Keeler nodded gravely.
"I am sorry, Alex. Yes, they informed me earlier. But anyway, let the orderlies look after you, and then get some rest. Dr. Henschel will want to debrief you as soon as possible."
Keeler looked around for a moment, then spied Ekristina nearby.
"It's good to see you again," he said to Alex. "But please, excuse me. I will speak to you later."
And with that he was gone, talking agitatedly with Chris, as an orderly dressed a wound on her forehead. She shook her head in reply to his questioning, and shrugged, upon which the small man exploded in a fit of rage, cursing and yelling at her.
"Do you realise how important that information was?"
Alex heard him yell.
"Well, it's out there in the transport if you want it so badly,"
Chris spat back in her defence.
"I'm sorry, but I was too busy trying to prevent myself from being ripped apart limb from limb to worry about your damn notes."
Keeler cursed and stormed off.
"What was all that about?"
asked Alex, sitting down next to her.
"Oh, it's just the work we pulled from that Sullivan guy at his university. His notes, hard drive and stuff. I neglected to salvage them from the transport. And I think Keeler was a bit pissed."
She laughed grimly.
"I've never seen him like that before,"
whispered Alex in concern.
"We'll get used to it, Alexei," she smiled. "There's a lot of it going about."
Thomas paused at the door to the bar. It was dimly lit and packed full of people.
"Are you okay, Thomas?" asked Susan as she peered through the crowd for a free table.
Thomas nodded nervously. It was the first time he had been inside any of the base's two pubs. He always got anxious in crowds, and his head was already spinning with the things he had just seen. Susan led him to the bar.
"What can I get you?"
she asked breathlessly.
I don't know. Whatever you're having,"
shouted Thomas above the din. She laughed lightly and squeezed between two men who were waiting to be served, leaving Thomas fidgeting awkwardly on his own. He looked nervously around, and his eye caught that of a man next to him who stared back. Thomas quickly turned away
and heard the man snigger to his companion. "Come on, I've spotted some friends. We can get a seat, I think." It was Susan, back with 2 pints of lager. Thomas followed her through the melee, trying desperately not to spill his drink. "James, Andy, how are you doing?" shouted Susan over the noise of the music, upon finally reaching a small table in a dark corner. "Hey, Sue," called one of the men. "We'd given up on you. There's a seat there for you." "Oh, cheers. Is Jill out with you tonight?" she asked, sitting down at the table. "She's just gone to make a phone call. The cancelled weekend leave again. Can you believe it?" shouted James. He was a big man, wearing a tight red t-shirt and jeans. He had short, spiky blonde hair and a wide smile. "What have you been up to?" he asked, leaning close to Susan's ear. "Oh, I've had a great day," began Susan, then suddenly looked around, remembering Thomas, who she'd left standing awkwardly at the table. "Oh God, how rude of me." She turned to Thomas and cheerfully gestured him to sit beside her. "Guys, this is Thomas Sullivan. He's new here. I've been showing him around the library and stuff. Thomas, this is Andy Garner. He works in the programming department. And this is James Eden, who, if he ever does any work at all, which I doubt, does it down in the security section." She laughed gaily, and both men shook hands with Thomas with a smile, though Thomas thought he could detect a look of derision on their faces. "And what do you do, Thomas?" asked James with a grin. Thomas mumbled an inaudible reply. "What?" shouted James over the din. "Geek police," muttered Andy out of the corner of his mouth, and the 2 men burst into hysterics. Susan bit her lip and put her drink to her mouth to hide her sniggers. "All right, boys, playtime's over," she chastised them, when she had regained her composure. "Thomas is a..." She paused and looked curiously at him. "What is it you do, actually?" she asked. "Just bits and bobs, theory stuff, really, sort of," muttered Thomas, cringing with embarrassment. James and Andy sniggered again. I think I should better get going," stuttered Thomas. He stood up and flashed a shy glance at Susan. She was whispering something to Andy, who was laughing hysterically to himself. Hurriedly, Thomas turned and squeezed his way through the throng. He burst back out into the quiet corridors and made his way to the fire escape, which took him down 3 levels to A section. He had got to know his way around the lower levels after almost 2 weeks of running errands, and he quickly made his way towards his favourite thinking spot. "It was foolish to have gone into the bar," he chastised himself. He felt sick to his stomach. He had just wanted to be with her a while longer. "He should have known all her friends would be so much better than him," he cursed. He had just showed himself up for being the stupid fool he was. He reached the correct level and headed off down a dim service corridor. The walls were of rough concrete, painted a sickly green, and a jumble of pipes hung just above Thomas's head. He made his way through the twists and turns, feeling the air get steadily warmer. Then all of a sudden he was out of the cramped tunnel, standing at the edge of a thin walkway, which stretched out precariously over a vast open space. He shuffled around the edge and settled himself down in the small alcove, which had become one of his favourite places to work. He was sitting about 60 feet up from the floor of the array. The thin walkway stretched dizzily across a huge chasm to a massive generator tower, from which a constant low throb emanated. From his vantage point, Thomas had a magnificent view of the gargantuan workings of the array spread out before him. Far across the empty space, amongst the forests of pipes, he could make out the tiny shapes of engineers scurrying across precipitous gantries, and high, high above him, he could make out the faint red glow of the windows of control, thrusting out from the sheer walls. The tiny glowing points of the glass-walled lifts moved lazily up and down the immense structure. Gases and vapours rose steadily from 100 different places, and Thomas felt the steady low hum of machinery and the reassuring odour of oil and heavy engineering. He gazed out across all of this, so excited at last to be a part of it, but then remembered the look of derision Susan's friends had given him in the bar. He tried to get their laughter out of his mind. He sat alone, high above the array, and burst into tears.
"So, can we just go through it one more time, to make sure I've got this straight?" came Detective Scott's dismissive tone.
You had no warning devices for alerting you to electromagnetic fields caused by your equipment during your experiments. Doesn't that sound a little negligent on your behalf? He sat back in his seat, eyeing Grace mistrustfully across the small table. Grace stubbed out yet another cigarette and put her head in her hands.
I told you, she said distantly. We didn't consider it necessary. We never thought...
Her voice trailed off to nothing. She looked up as the door behind Scott opened and a squat, balding man in a dark suit walked in. He leant casually down to Scott's ear and muttered something to him.
You don't have the authority, exploded the young detective. This is my investigation. I don't care who you lot are.
He stood up angrily and stopped the cassette recorder on the desk.
Excuse me one moment, Dr. Palmer, he said, barely containing his anger.
The squat man stood impassively beside him. Scott turned and strode out of the room, followed by the other man, leaving Grace alone at last. She had been in the interview room for the past 3 hours, going over the same vague details. It was obvious to Palmer that Scott didn't have the first clue about the nature of the investigation, but his assistant, Leeson, by contrast, had seemed to know what he was looking for when searching the Maundsworth database. But Grace had given up now. After all she had been through, to be the cause of so much tragedy, she was numb to everything. She didn't even hear the door open again as Scott returned. Dr. Palmer, he called, breaking her from her thoughts. He still seemed angry, but now he had a beaten look about him.
Dr. Palmer, that will be all for now, thank you. A car will return you back to the base. I'll be calling on you again in the next day or so to ask some more questions. And please cooperate with the team conducting investigations on site. Goodbye, Dr. Palmer.
He showed her to the door of the interview room, and from there a uniformed policeman escorted her out of the station. As she followed him in a daze, she caught sight of the balding man again. He was stood at the door to an office, watching her intently as she passed. When Grace caught his eye, the man turned back into the room, closing the door behind him. Half an hour later, Grace was stood watching the police car drive away. It was just starting to rain, but the icy droplets splashed on her face without her noticing. A soldier ran out from the main building, and darting down the steps through the shower, called to her,
Dr. Palmer, Commander James asked me to escort you to his office upon your return. Would you follow me, please?
Unresponsive, she let herself be led away once more through the rain.
We must strike now whilst we still have the chance, shouted Henschel, banging his fist down on the table.
We just don't have the resources for a full-scale attack, sighed someone on the other side of the table.
We must wait until our new weapons are fully deployed, said another.
Nonsense, retorted Henschel. Their industrial production will far outstrip ours, which is why we must strike now.
But how can we hope to even reach the Americans without our new aircraft? It is impossible.
It is not the Americans we should be concerned with. It is the British who are the source. Destroy them and it will be the end of it.
Alex held his head in his hands. He felt as if his mind would burst. He had been sat in the corner, listening to the same arguments for over 4 hours, and still they were no further on. His headaches were almost intolerable now, a splinter behind his eyes, reminding him of the fate which ultimately awaited him. He still hadn't dared to tell anybody about it. He realized the conference room had gone silent.
Well, Alexei, you are the only remainder of the British team. Is an assault possible?
Dr. Henschel appraised Alex with his penetrating gaze. His face was heavily lined and careworn, yet he remained a proud and powerful figure. He stood with his fists planted squarely upon the piles of maps and charts which littered the huge conference table. Alex stood up slowly and self-consciously, in the company of so many great minds.
I think both sides of the argument are correct, he began.
A jolt of pain hit him and he closed his eyes for a second, steadying himself on the back of Keeler's chair.
We have not the strength for a full assault,
but it would be folly to think that we could wait until our new craft are fully developed. There were murmurs around the table.
Of course, began Henschel, once more in his low, booming voice. The damage is done now. The Americans are close to completion of their own arrays. Soon I predict that the stability of the field will fail. We must...
Henschel ceased in mid-sentence,
a look of astonishment on his face, as Alex held up an authoritative hand.
"It would be folly to wait," continued Alex again.
He felt a strange sense of detachment as he spoke, as if he were an observer on the scene.
"So we must strike in the only way available, and limit the damage our enemies can inflict."
The conference room, deep underground, was deathly quiet, as all listened attentively to Alex's words.
"The most important resource at this stage is knowledge. The Americans, who are out of our reach for the time being anyway, are severely limited. The source of their knowledge, an understanding of the field, is the intelligence stolen from the British base. We do not know the identity of their spy there, so we are unable to sever the link that way. Our only option is to remove the source of the British knowledge. We must infiltrate the base and remove the leaders of their research."
An anxious murmur ran through the room. Most of those present were scientists and were tired of the constant war they waged.
"Do you mean infiltrate the base via the field?" someone asked.
"Of course," replied Alex distantly.
"The security is too tight, and we don't have enough time to do it any other way. The field is still our strongest source of surprise."
"But it would be suicide,"
came an exclamation from across the table.
"We have our new weapons. They would be dead before they knew that we were there," shouted another. "We do not need to kill them," said Alex quietly. "We could capture them, bring them back, as we have done in the past. They would be of great benefit to our work here."
"It is too risky. We must stamp them all out," came a shout from the end of the table.
"I can't believe I'm hearing this," shouted another. "We are dedicated to peace. All this talk of murder is too much to bear."
"Fool! We have passed that point a long time ago. This is a war of survival. We must go on." "Quiet!" yelled Alexei.
He looked at the bemused and startled faces around him, and for a moment, a scene of strange, grotesque figures, such as he had seen before, hovered translucently over his vision. The bestial figures were all locked in a futile struggle with each other, scratching, biting, and lashing out in rage. The image disappeared instantly, and he smiled as he heard himself speaking in a voice distant and unfamiliar.
"I will lead a team in from the field. We will attempt to capture the leaders of the research, upon whom everything hinges. That may buy us the time we need."
He walked out of the conference room, leaving the others stunned and silent.
You have been listening to The Heaven Field. For more information, downloads, and artwork, visit theheavenfield.com.